last week.
Yeah, I think that I should go into more detail on what preceded the private meeting.
Great, good.
Because I went over this and I think I skimmed over it much too lightly. Last week, when our commission, presidential commission, got to Hanoi on the day of our arrival, which was the 16th of March, we went to the government guest house about 3:30 and then very unexpectedly met with the foreign minister at 5 o'clock, Nguyen Duy Trinh, which was pretty much a formality, and I think their way of saying to us the seriousness that they attached to the visit, although it was the foreign minister put out again the same hard line that the Vietnamese had been pursuing. That evening was free. We went walking around the city. I might say that the Vietnamese had said to us that we should not even go out in twos and threes, that we should go out a large number together because they could not account for our safety otherwise with the strong feelings of the people. Well, that didn't happen. The people slipped away, one and two. Group I went with after dinner, I think there were three of us, four maybe, but it was absolutely, there was great curiosity, but there was absolutely no evidence of any hostility on the part of the Vietnamese. And the next morning, we met with Deputy Foreign Minister Phan Hien at 8:30, and I had a prepared statement which we had all gone over and read that statement, in which the emphasis, of course, was on the problem of the missing in action, having an accounting for that, and that this should be handled separately, and that we had to dispose of this because it was a political obstruction to improvement in the relations between the two countries as far as the reactions of the American people were concerned. Phan Hien had proposed when we started at 8:30 that we go to 12:30, but we take a break. Go to 12:30 and we take a break at 10:30. And in his response, he began by saying, first of all, I would like to say that this opportunity is important to the process leading to the normalization of relations. And that was very much on his mind. Then he spoke about global relations at some length. And then he got to the point of the U.S.-Vietnam relations. Among other things he said, "To my great regret, I have to record here my saying this to one person who is not present here, dear Henry," he referred to him. A few months before he left the State Department, he said, "Vietnam needs normalization of relations with the U.S. more than the U.S. needs this with Vietnam." What does he mean? And then he went on, yesterday and today, this morning, Mr. Chairman, referring to me, you referred to sterile, stale negotiations. Why were these negotiations sterile? We can draw conclusions on that. Of late, Secretary Vance, whom we had the pleasure to meet in Paris, said that normalization between Vietnam and the U.S. is beneficial to both countries. Of course, this statement is different from that by Mr. Kissinger. And then he went on to say, let me speak about the question of U.S. responsibility to contribute to the post-war reconstruction of Vietnam. This question includes three aspects. The first one is the legal aspect. I believe that when dealing with this aspect, it will take some time, but I shall speak briefly because there are many things of which you are already aware, but there are some that you do not yet know. For instance, one point I mentioned to Mr. Montgomery when he came here. That was Sonny Montgomery, who'd been there in 1975. And he said that only then did he know that point. The first legal basis is Article 21. It must be known to you because you have read it carefully. The U.S. undertakes to contribute to the healing of the wounds of war and post-war reconstruction of Vietnam. The second basis is the written message by President Nixon, addressed to Premier Pham Van Dong on February 1, 1973, of which I inform Representative Montgomery. Mr. Holbrooke, whom I knew very well in Paris, said that the present administration had no responsibility toward the Nixon message. This is what has been said in radio and press. I don't know whether this is true or not. You must have read the message. But it is said that no one in the U.S. Congress knows about the message. I would like to refer to one point raised by Mr. Kissinger in the course of negotiations. After a meeting on January 13, 1973, he read this message to Le Duteau. I would like to tell you very secretly, Mr. Special Advisor, that probably we shall have to present this matter very secretly to the chairman of the Appropriations Subcommittee of our Congress. He also said in the course of negotiations he would have to approach a number of U.S. congressmen about the amount of the contribution. So then finally, Van Hien went on, I would also add that besides the $3.25 billion of U.S. contribution that arises from Article 21 on the so-called recent reconstruction reparations, there is also an understanding between the United States and Vietnam in regard to other forms of aid. Let me read it. In regard to other forms of aid, the U.S. indicates that the appropriate programs could fall in the range of $1 billion to $1.5 billion. Depending on food and other commodity needs. This is besides the $3.25 billion. End of quote. I reveal this to you today. I wonder whether this is known to you. And I said, yes, we know, because these had been made known to us in the letter of existence, and its content had been made known to us in the State Department. Oh, of course, we did not have a copy with us. Van Hien went on, another legal point is a letter of Mr. Morris Williams, chairman of the U.S. delegation of the Joint Economic Commission. He wrote to the head of the Vietnamese delegation of the JEC. He said, it's my understanding that related agreements in principle, number one, Article 21 of the January 27, 1973 Paris Agreement on ending the war and restoring peace in Vietnam, and two, agreements between the Democratic Republic of Vietnam and the U.S., specified in an exchange of letters between Nixon and Pham Van Dong and between the two parties in Hanoi. The JEC discussed the detailed list of goods and commodities supplied to the Democratic Republic of Vietnam to be supplied over a period of 5 years. Some Americans say that the Paris Agreement has become valueless and it is dead. When a State Department spokesman was asked by journalists and the press whether the Paris Agreement was null and void, he replied that it's not definite whether the Paris Agreement is still in value or in force or not. Now, if we believe that the Paris Agreement is not in force, we wonder whether Article 8B is in force. Article 8B went to the question of their responsibility to solve the MIA question, for which, of course, we were there. If the agreement is no longer in force, then both Articles 8B and 21 no longer exist. If 8B remains, then 21 must remain, too. I think that all jurists can come to the same conclusions. And then he went on in his conclusion. Now, the third aspect I would like to deal with, besides the legal and humanitarian aspects of the problem. Both questions of Article 8B and Article 21 contain both aspects, legal and humanitarian. We can look at these problems, these two problems, from either angle alone. Now, the third aspect is mutual benefit and reciprocity. There is no reason that action is taken by one side only, and the interest is on one side only, or that one side must implement one article and the other side refuses to carry out its commitment. I once told Mr. Montgomery I wanted this commitment. Regarding Article 8B, we have done our utmost, we have made efforts, and we should continue our efforts, our endeavors. But why ask our people to participate in the search and cooperation? We'll be asked about the responsibility of the U.S. to contribute to the healing of the wounds of war. What about this obligation? Vietnamese families have lost their members, Vietnamese houses have been destroyed by U.S. bombs. And what have the American people said about these questions? If we told our people that we let you find out the information and about the Americans missing and left out the question of reciprocity, I am sure I would not be able to remain in my post of the Foreign Ministry, because this is the worst way. Therefore, both parties should take into account the needs and concern of the other party. And shortly after that, he said, let's take a break. This was at 10:40 in the morning. It was as we broke that we were all very much in a state of shock, because this was a very hard-line position, absolutely no change, no indication of any change. And as I said in our last session, I said to my colleagues that, relating to my own experiences, if this were a strike, I'd say it's going to last 6 months more. And we had had the understanding initiated by Mike Mansfield that if we ran into a stone wall, I should seek a private meeting with Phan Hien, as I related. During the break, I went to the interpreter, Vietnamese interpreter, and asked for this meeting, which we broke at 10:40, and about half an hour went by, and then at 11:10, I joined Phan Hien and the interpreter. As I said in the last session, I did not take one of the American staff who understood Vietnamese, because I figured it was better to do it that way, on the basis that if nothing positive came out of it, then the meeting had never taken place, which is a device which we'd use very successfully in tough bargaining situations with the auto companies. And I just thought there was possibly more chance of them being more open if it were on that basis. Now, actually, the session only lasted, reviewing my notes, only lasted a little over 10 minutes. And we sat down, and I went immediately to the point. I said that what we heard this morning is not going to lead anywhere, that these matters have to be separated. That the American people have the perception that you are trying to sell us back the remains of our men. And no matter how they felt about the war, the reaction to that is universally bad. And if this commission cannot go back with a positive report, then you may as well forget about normalization of relations between our two countries for 10, 12 years. I said, you can't get a better commission than this one. I said, you know where I stood on the war. You certainly know where Mike Mansfield stood on the war. You know where Charlie Yost stood on the war. And I think you also know where Marion Edelman stood on the war. As far as Sonny Montgomery is concerned, his position there was different, but he has shown great political courage in his congressional report on the missing in action question to try and defuse that troublesome problem between us. And I just emphasized and reemphasized that if we could not go back with a positive report on this question, separating these matters, then they may as well just dig in, because the relationship between the two countries would stay bad for a long time. Well, he did not at that, Fan Hien did not at that time say anything positive, but his silence wasn't silent so much as he didn't argue with me. He didn't. He said yes, they knew very well the personal positions of all those making up the commission, which I'm sure they did, and that we should go back into meetings. And but the atmosphere was positive. I was quite optimistic. I then told them of an experience that Mike Mansfield and I had that morning. This is just before we broke. The government house was right across from the lake of the lake in which there's a rock in the middle in which the sword is supposed to have been plunged. It was taken out by the Vietnamese hero who fought the Chinese invasion in what was it, the 10th, 11th century, anyway, a long time ago. And there's a walkway all around it. Before breakfast, Mike and I went for a walk. And two little girls, well, they would have been 8 years old, I guess. And one is, they're a few paces away, and we're moving towards them. One was squatting down, looking at something in the dirt. And the other one is looking with her, but she suddenly looks up and sees us and exclaims, must have said foreigners or whatever. And the other one looked up. She had an extremely lovely face, and then she turned her head, and there was a slash mark across the one side of her face, which was a burn. Mike and I both commented, probably came from bomb fragments or something. And so I mentioned this and said how tragic everything had been. The interpreter had tears rolled down his cheek. So I come out, and naturally everybody was most curious, and I said, I think everything's going to be all right, but I said, I don't know. I was not given any assurance of any kind. And as I had left him, he had said, let us go back into a meeting. already overdue. So we reassembled at 11:25, and we sat down, and I said, "We are ready, Mr. Vice Minister." And he had papers in front of him. And he said, "I am not quite ready." "I need another briefcase." And they bring him in another briefcase in which he takes three documents out and he sorts them around. And then he looks at this document and the one he chose after, this probably took, all of it took 5-7 minutes. And then he laid the documents aside and he started by saying that, let's take up the question of the MIAs in Vietnam. He said, "I would like to affirm here that this question comes under the responsibility of the four parties to the Paris Agreement of Vietnam. Now only two parties remain. The United States government and the Socialist Republic of Vietnam." And said that his government had done their best to implement the Article 8B. But there were MIAs in areas that not under their control, but we have tried to do what we could. Then he talked about Americans who remained being required to register, that was widely disseminated, and that the after registry were permitted to leave, and that they were not holding anybody.
That's an important point. At that point, he did say, didn't he, that there was not a single live American. What did, because in I raised the question in light of the Garwood case.
Well, after he made this brief statement.
Yes.
The significance of which was he talked only about the MIAs.
Right.
It was not interconnected.
Right.
I said to him, "Are there any who might be defined as criminals under your law?" He said, "None. All who registered have been returned." Edelman then said, "Do you have any information on any Americans who did not register and remain in Vietnam?" He said, "We only know of those who registered." Mike Mansfield asked, "Had any Americans become naturalized as Vietnamese citizens?" He didn't know of any. And Montgomery said, "There are no Americans living in North Vietnam?" He said, "You can draw your conclusions from my statement. All those who registered themselves or have asked to leave have been allowed to leave. But we have no knowledge of those cases of Americans who have not registered. When Senator McGovern came here, he gave us some names. We did the best we could, but we didn't find any of them. There are no captives." And then Montgomery then raised the question of Tucker Gugelman, who was a special case on which we had a special meeting after the dinner that night. And then he said, in answer to that, he said, "No one is kept in prison. I shall refer the name of Tucker Gugelman to the appropriate service. We can assure you we do not keep any American in custody now. If they register, they are allowed to leave." And then he said, "I would like to say that because of the conditions of the war, a very atrocious war, climatic conditions, the tropical climate, and unfavorable circumstances have caused a great deal of difficulties in seeking information about Americans who lost their lives in Vietnam. Last night I explained to Mr. Montgomery about the difficulties. For example, planes falling in the sea, the forest, the jungle, and the rivers. Sometimes your computer mentioned the place, but we found nothing. And of course, the numbers that we were talking about as MIAs included any Americans missing any place over the ocean or whatever. And
something like 2,000, if I remember, wasn't it?
I forget the number. It was a substantial number. Although the recovery rate in this war was just far beyond Korea, the Korean War, or World War II.
Yeah, it's a small. Actually, 4% I looked into that. It's
like
that's why I say it's 2,000 out of the total of 50,000. 2,000 remains were not recovered, and it is by far the lowest percentage of any war in which the United States has fought. I think in the Korean War is as high as 30%.
And even World War II was
higher.
Was very high, yes. So then Fonian said, we sympathize with the anguish and anxiety of the American families who've lost their relatives. Therefore, in the past as well as the present, our government will make the greatest efforts possible to seek information about the MIAs. A specialized office has been set up for the purpose of seeking information. Some of the members of this office are present here, and this morning I have introduced them to you. As a result of the search operation since the signing of the Paris Agreement, the government of Vietnam has taken the initiative and unilaterally returned the remains of a number of Americans who lost their lives in Vietnam. And then he said, in September 1976, we informed the U.S. side that we have found information and remains of 12 American pilots. Of course, those had been offered, and they tied it in with the vote in the UN on their seating, as I remember it. Anyway, it was another bargain deal. And when the U.S. Was not forthcoming, I'm quite sure it was a UN vote, they then did not permit them to go to the remains to be taken out. That attitude of seriousness and goodwill of our government has been warmly welcomed by public opinion. We have decided to return to you the remains of these 12 pilots. We have put them in a place, and if you would like to go and see the remains, we have arranged for you to see them tomorrow. Give us the date when you wish to take away these remains. You can take them right away, or you can leave them and take them when you want later. We would like to mark our meeting at this time by this action. This time, understanding your concern, we would like to make the following statement. In the spirit of humanity and a show of goodwill and friendship to the American people, the government of the Socialist Republic of Vietnam will fully inform the U.S. and will give to the U.S. side all available information about the Americans missing and will satisfactorily resolve the question of remains of Americans who lost their lives in the war the Vietnamese side has found. In the course of the search operation, any further result in the operation will be communicated to the U.S. government as soon as possible by the government of the SRV. The government of Vietnam will welcome the contribution and the assistance of the USG in the search operation by furnishing us with any information or documents and by supplying us with the necessary means for the search operation. As to the experts Montgomery referred to in Manila, that was not Manila, that was Honolulu, the identification lab. They really do remarkable work.
Yes.
You know, one bone fragment, and they can determine the blood type, and it's really remarkable.
That's one where they discovered subsequently one remain was not was a Vietnamese,
yes,
really.
Right. We've explained the situation. It's inconvenient for us to have personnel. Montgomery had talked to them on the side about bringing them to Hanoi, and this was rejected. We can receive information, documents you have on hand, and we can receive the means and the materials you will supply. Thus we believe we have shown we are prepared to fulfill our responsibility with respect to the missing. With the statement I have just made here, I think you will return to the U.S., Mr. Chairman, to assure the U.S. President that a new process is open for the satisfactory solution of this problem. We have shown our utmost goodwill. This is what I have to say about Article 8B. I would like to repeat, we should be realistic. We shall do our best. And then he spoke about other matters in their membership in the UN and so on, and referring to a statement that Andrew Young had made shortly before that in indicating a different position that the U.S. was ready to take. And then he went on, I thank you for the appreciation expressed by Mr. Chairman by saying the Vietnamese are a proud people and a courageous people. We've explained to you a number of our difficulties and we've presented to you a number of pressing requirements. This is a matter of your conscience. We have no intention to beg from anyone. We have self-respect, we're a proud people, we know how to produce things by the labor of our own efforts. We would rather tighten our belts than lose our self-respect. It's our hope that we will develop by our own effort, by our labor, and then afterward by the normalization between our two countries, including trade relations and relations including loans and repayments. This is not strange, but normal relations. I have expounded to you the immediate steps to be taken and also the step to be taken in the long period to come. In sum, the policy I have expounded to you includes 3 points. 1, regarding Article 21, I have expounded to you. 2, Article 8B, I have expounded that position. 3, regarding the normalization of relations between our two countries, I have expressed our views. I think we should not consider any one of these 3 points as preconditions to the other two. It is not our intention to raise the question in this way, but these points are closely related to each other. And then he apologized for the length of his speech, and saying, since we live so very far, communication is not so convenient. I responded by saying, as you know, we are not a diplomatic mission. We're a unique group. And I don't know whether there have been other similar groups in our history. So when we say the Vietnamese are a proud and courageous people, it's not diplomatic jargon. It comes from our heart. We have come in a spirit of friendship representing our new president. We hope in the process of these talks we can diffuse the sensitive and political issue of the MIAs. We wish to reduce our problem to realistic terms and to be able to go back and report to the President that this problem is in the process of being solved. The statement you have made relative to the 12 pilots is reassuring, and we thank you for it. The rest of the things we have heard, I think, have laid a basis for resolving this problem. You have said if we had any documents to submit, we shall do that. Maybe while we are still here, we will also submit a new list of names, whatever information we have relative to them. And we hope that when we leave Hanoi on Saturday morning, we can have a positive report to make to our president and through him to the American people. Two long tragic events have kept our peoples apart. We have a national interest in the stability of Southeast Asia. That stability is dependent upon the well-being and prosperity of your country. We can direct our policies toward normalization. There are many things that can happen to our mutual benefit. We look forward to meeting with your Prime Minister this afternoon. We look forward to the opportunity to say to him directly that he is a great leader of your nation, that we think we have the beginning of a new relationship. And Montgomery said, I have had the privilege from the legislative branch to come to your country more than any other member. This is my 11th trip to Vietnam. I am happy at this time to look forward to other trips, which I trust will also be as pleasant. As you know, I know of the suffering of your people as well as the suffering of the U.S., the terrible war we've been involved with during the past number of years. my experience in the missing in action and the prisoner of war field, I think you made a very strong statement, in my opinion, that this time, which will resolve the MIA problem. Some of the American families will never be satisfied, because in World War II, we have 79,000 Americans whose remains we never recovered. I think you have placed the last plank that was needed in the bridge of friendship to bring about normalization. And I speak as a member of Congress. I invite you as my friend to come to the U.S. in the near future. May I add, and Fan Hien responded, may I add one more sentence, Mr. Chairman? The views that we have been exchanging here, of course, we should think over. I think that later the two parties should continue the negotiations. We shall choose the best place for this purpose. We can meet anywhere, maybe Paris or Hanoi. What I would like to say is that we have understood the principles we've pointed out to the other side. To put into effect these things, it's necessary to have diplomats, the experts, to talk to one another. I think it's the next step. If, Mr. Chairman, you think we can make a positive report, then the next step will be that the two parties will meet again and negotiate for the implementation as soon as possible. We have worked hard this morning.
You know, I'm astounded. I did not realize that their preconditions were dropped in that session. And it's very clear that they were.
Yeah.
Is it your sense from that session that Fan Hien made his decision at that point, or that he came into the meeting with three or four alternative?
I think this was an alternative that he had.
A fallback position.
Yes.
And then your private session with him, in effect, elicited his most forthcoming position.
I think that's the essence of it, yes.
And then you were able to do that in part by saying, let's separate these things out, but this administration, in effect, is prepared, if the MIA issue is settled, to move forward down a track toward normalization. That was our position.
You're right. And which Secretary Vance had stated publicly, as he referred to.
That's right.
In his remarks.
That's right.
Right.
Fascinating. I had not focused on that clearly.
So we then broke and we had lunch by ourselves, and everybody was feeling very good. Then at 3:30 we went to the palace to see Premier Pham Van Dong. Of course, I had a letter, personal letter for him from President Carter. So we get to the palace, and there was a long two rows of steps, quite a number of them. And Pham Van Dong is up at the top waiting for us. We get out of cars and we're at the bottom. And we're going up the steps, and Jim Rosenthal, our chief staff person, is just behind my right shoulder, and he suddenly says, my God, I forgot the letter. And I said, well, you better go and get it. So he disappears, and we continue on up. We meet the premier, and he takes us in, and we sit down side by side with the commission members on both sides. And all of the TV is there, the American TV we'd brought, as well as their TV, the Vietnamese TV. And they're grinding away, and they keep grinding, and waiting for me to present the letter that everybody knows I'm going to give, but I don't have a letter. And so I had to keep talking about my two countries, et cetera, et cetera. Premier must have been wondering what was going on too, and finally somebody sent the TV and the radio to press people away. But we had nothing of substance was discussed, of course, but it was a very, very friendly meeting. And I forget just how it happened, but when Jim brought me the letter, I was able to give it to him in a very appropriate way, tied to something he had said, and I forget now what it was. But he made some reference to President Carter. And so, oh, by the way, Mr. Premier. So, too bad the TV wasn't there at that time. And at the beginning, he was...
Do you remember what that letter said?
I don't think it went directly to the question of normalization. I think it was in general terms, hoping for the betterment of relations between the
two. I vaguely remember being involved in the writing of that. Yeah. That I vaguely remember. I think that was my first experience with obtaining a presidential letter and the forms that had to be used and all of that. Right.
I think, too, it went to the question of the need to
put a past behind us.
Put the MIA question as the signal to the end.
That's right. And that it was that our two nations were looking forward and was an effort to point out a new beginning, that kind of thing.
Right.
That's what I vaguely remember.
And then that afternoon after the session with the Premier, that's when we visited the Historical Museum, and said last week, but our attention was drawn to their triumphs over the Chinese, the feudal Chinese, feudalist Chinese. And that night we had, in the guest house, they gave a dinner for us. And it was a very, very good dinner.
What was it, Western food? French?
French.
French.
French, yes. And one of the, we had a military delegation with us. One of the colonels was seated right across the table from a Vietnamese army man, and they discovered they had fought against each other in certain places in the South. And it was a very warm evening. Then, following the dinner, they put on a cultural show, also in the guest house, which was quite new and had just been built. I think we were the second occupants. And the cultural show was non-ideological. There was no propaganda in it at all. That. Then again, the next morning, we had further discussions, but this went to the question of the implementation, and that was a relatively short session. And later that morning, we had set up a subcommittee from our, including members of the commission and staff members, to meet with their MIA people to try and get some meeting of the minds on implementation. Mansfield and I were not in that. We were standing by, and they broke. Some of the staff people were being very picky, you know, nitpicking things. And throw a Vietnamese had just made an 180-degree turn. And I'm sure that the bureaucrats of that level were not quite with it. I remember saying, we're not going to snatch defeat out of the jaws of victory. Let's not pursue it that way.